Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton, and I'm the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149. And to indicate you have a question, simply press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you'll be placed in the queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Today's guests are going to discuss collateral consequences for youth who've had contact with the juvenile and adult justice systems and explore some approaches to reduce their adverse effects. While the laws and consequences of adjudications in juvenile court or convictions in adult criminal court vary from state to state, there are many common challenges or harms that youth experience related to their exposure to justice systems that is not part of the imposed disposition or sentence. So on this episode, we're going to unpack all of this. Joining us for the discussion are Alyssa Johnson, who is a staff attorney in the Jackson, Mississippi office of the Southern Poverty Law Center, also known as SPLC. SPLC is a nonprofit civil rights organization dedicated to fighting hate and bigotry and to seeking justice for the most vulnerable members of society. SPLC's Mississippi office focuses primarily on systemic reform related to criminal justice, juvenile justice, education, and mental health. Alyssa is originally from Lexington, Kentucky. She received her bachelor's in English and sociology from Fisk University and her Juris Doctor and master's in social work from Loyola University Chicago. Dr. Ashley Nellis, who leads the Sentencing Project's research and legislative activities in juvenile justice reform and serves on several youth-serving coalitions and working groups in the Washington, D.C. area. She has extensive academic and professional background in analyzing criminal justice policies and practice, including examining disparities among youth of color in the juvenile justice system. She co-authored Back on Track, Supporting Youth Reentry from Out-of-Home Placement to the Community, and has written about collateral consequences of a delinquency record. Ashley received her doctorate in justice law and society from American University School of Public Affairs. And our third guest is Lisa Thoreau, who is the Executive Director of Strategies for Youth, Inc. For the past 10 years, she has focused on the implications of collateral consequences for youth. Among many things, Lisa has worked to draft state legislation to increase protections of juvenile records, persuaded the Boston Housing Authority to abide by state law and drop its demand that applicants for public housing disclose their children's juvenile records, and worked with police officers to create Think About It cards, which warn youth of the consequences of arrest and court involvement. For 2 years, Lisa oversaw the research and collection of laws on the creation, storage, and distribution of juvenile arrest and court records for a nationwide study for the American Bar Association. Lisa has a master's in anthropology from Columbia University and received her Juris Doctor from Cardozo School of Law. So I'd like to welcome all three of you to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Ashley, perhaps you can start us off. What do we mean by collateral consequences?
Typically, when we're talking about collateral consequences of a delinquency conviction or in the adult system, an adult criminal justice conviction, we're talking about the things that happen, negative consequences that happen outside of the actual adjudication of delinquency. And these relate usually and most severely to issues in education, issues with gaining employment, getting housing, and also being kept off of registries, which are becoming more and more popular. And so there's a number of consequences that youth face in all of these areas. But I think that in order to really understand how troubling this is, it's important to remember where we, you know, come from in terms of the foundational principles of our juvenile justice system. You know, we haven't had a juvenile justice system that's apart from the criminal justice system. You know, we developed that in the late 19th century. And the reason for that, among other things, was that we wanted for youth to be handled in an informal, non-adversarial, and highly confidential way. And the foundation of that system was born out of a concern that youth were being, exposed and, given this mark of deviance that carried with them for the rest of their lives, even though the vast majority never had any real involvement beyond the first interaction with the justice system. So there was this idea that, we wanted to have a different system for youth, which is why we have different terms for youth in the system: delinquent, adjudicated, detention, terms that are sort of softer and more rehabilitation focused. And, this was emphasized again, even though a lot of legal protections were afforded to youth in the 60s and 70s, even though N. Ray Gault and other cases, made the system a little bit more like the criminal justice system, there was still this real emphasis that we need to protect the privacy of youth matters because they are so capable of reform. And then, finally in the 80s and 90s, we saw there was this huge interest in public accountability and, putting bad kids out there and making sure that sentences were really tough. And what happened was that we largely eased the ways that individuals and groups could learn about an individual's delinquent behavior and impose additional sanctions based on that. Currently folks like us and the other speakers on the call are, among the groups that are trying to turn back to the original foundation of the juvenile justice system and keep youth matters private and away from all of these collateral consequences that we see in schooling and employment and home, homelessness.
Alyssa, Lisa, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I would. Good, Alyssa. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Lisa.
I would just add that one of the things that the description of the court process, Ashley, is Robin Target and the history of the movement away to a more accountability focused. Meant more disclosure of what had previously been given information about youth. So right now, as we see people being transferred into the adult courts, their records in adult court are getting the same lack of private adult records are. And you have some funny states like Massachusetts where adult records can be closed to the public after 7 or 10 years, and records that show a dismissal of a case will not be disclosed at all, whereas you don't have that protection for dismissals of juvenile cases. The other thing that I think is worth mentioning is just as registries are more prevalent, one of the other sad things that you see is the youth who tend to lose public benefits are because they have a record, are also the youth who are most likely given a record because of the confounding of poverty and juvenile justice in our country. So the poorest kids are experiencing the most harsh impacts of and disparately feeling the impacts of juvenile records. So it's a funny kind of like public registry that's occurring that's leading kids receiving those benefits, losing them more. So if my daughter, and I live in a private house, if my daughter commits some kind of aggressive or drug-related crime, we are at no risk of losing housing. But if she lived in public housing, all that would be up for question. And this has further destabilized a lot of families. It has done a great job in marginalizing kids in the way other systems have not. And It's disproportionately, of course, affecting kids who are poor. And the other point I make is the other change that we think we're seeing when this ABA project was that increasingly police are disclosing records. Some states, it's absolutely prohibited for police to share that information. There are other states, like Washington State, where the police departments sell all the arrest data for juveniles and adults to private people who companies that process that information. And finally, the trend we're seeing is that while public agencies are being regulated about the disclosure of such records, private agencies are highly unregulated. So in those different ways, kids get caught up in records for something that may be as limited as a trespass, but that billows and steam and power thanks to these current systems of distributing the information.
So, Lisa, you're raising a lot of the public policy issues and how some of these things play out on the ground, there's a lot of myths about access to records and things like that, and I really do want to spend some more time talking about what is happening nationally, how states are responding to that. Lisa, I do want to let you know that you're kind of going in and out, fading in and out a little bit when you're speaking. So, we've been talking about sort of the focusing on collateral consequences generally as an issue of how it affects after a disposition or a conviction if a youth has been transferred to the adult system. But there's also sort of this concept of collateral consequences of just the mere exposure to the system itself. Alyssa, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I can. I think, you know, it's important to think that when kids are out of their homes and they're placed in detention, they're away from their families and they're outside of their community schools. There's a lot of facilities across the country that are doing, you know, wonderful things and taking care of the kids that are in their care. Here in Mississippi, you know, just in the past 5 years or so, the Southern Poverty Law Center has filed several lawsuits related to the conditions of confinement in county juvenile detention centers and even a state facility. And so it's important to consider some of the issues and some of the conditions that kids are going to face when they enter these facilities. For instance, here in Mississippi, although the conditions at each facility vary, there were some common themes that we noticed, such as, you know, a lack of rehabilitative programming, inadequate staff training, excessive cell confinement, excessive use of restraints and force. And so it's important to, you know, the staff that may be working with these children on a day-to-day basis may not be adequately trained to really respond to their needs and ensure that they're getting programming and services that would enable them when they return to their communities to hopefully reduce recidivism and place them in a position to, you know, to reenter their communities with the least amount of negative impact. I mean, from the research, we know that children who are involved in the juvenile justice system have a higher rate of mental health issues. They're typically more likely to have experienced some form of trauma in their life. And these risk factors, coupled with abusive conditions, can really lead to, you know, further psychological and physical harm to kids. In many jurisdictions, you know, secure confinement is used for low-level offenders, you know, kids that are picked up for very minor nonviolent offenses, and those kids can be better served in the communities, you know, where there's community-based alternatives that give them some supervision, but also some services to maybe address what's going on. When youth are in detention, you know, they are away from their families, and even in the best facilities, that means that they don't have the ability to, you know, interact with their families and continue to build those relationships and interact in a school setting with their peers. Depending upon the length of confinement, kids, you know, they may miss important instruction time that might, you know, impact, you know, whether or not they're able to be promoted to the next grade or participate in extracurricular activities and other things that we know kind of promote that social development that we want to see among our youth.
Lisa or Ashley, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I mean, I think that it's this is Ashley Nellis. The you know, it's important to recognize that when we when you know, we make the decision to place a person, a young person, in secure confinement at that age, we're doing so during sort of a critical period of their adolescent development, and so it should be reserved for just those who really, truly do need to be held in secure confinement. Because even in the best case scenario, where a youth is sent to a facility, let's say in Missouri, where you know they have very high standards, there's still you know, consequences that come with that. You know, that they're taken away from their peer group. There's a certain stigma that they have to overcome. And they're, you know, pulled away from normal social development during a critical period of their growing years. So, you know, there's a small fraction, of course, of kids who do need to go to secure confinement for a short period of time. But we need to, you know, really think about everything that we are doing when we make that decision, because it's not just that confinement, but it's lots of consequences that go with it. Some are easier to overcome than others.
I kind of wonder just what it is we want youth to understand from a juvenile justice involvement. I think that a lot of kids experience it as extremely punitive, as marginalizing and stigmatizing, and that it's extremely painful, and yet I'm not sure what positive lesson they're learning about redirecting their energy or behavior. And all this confusion is compounded when you see that not all arrests are legitimate, frankly, and that you can go deeper and deeper in the system for probation violation because you didn't go to school one day and you didn't politely respond to your mom, and so that is a condition of your terms of probation, and the consequence for that is being incarcerated. So, you know, when you think of the mixed messages we're giving kids about rehabilitation and doing the right thing, and then the almost sledgehammer approach we're taking to these little canaries for often very minor things, like, you know, stealing candy bars or stealing a pair of jeans, frankly, you got to wonder what our real point is. Is it to punish and to destroy, to put people in their place? I don't know. Sometimes that's what it feels like. But I think that when you add the collateral consequence piece on that too, you're also telling young people, you don't belong here. There's no way you're going to be part of this group. And so many young kids, young people don't understand how those collateral consequences work, that they're often quite concerned that they'll never be employed, that they'll never go to college. And that's why we really try to get correct information out there, because not only are they worried that they won't have these opportunities, but others are worried about the opposite, which is that all records are automatically sealed. And then they're shocked to find out that this nursing program they've been in has been all for naught because they have a record. So I think as a country, we're not really on the same page with each other, certainly within states and definitely across them, about what we really want the system to do with young people.
You know, I think it's really helpful for people to hear specific examples. You know, you've given a few of collateral consequences for youth and how it's played out in their lives. And, I mean, Lisa, you're talking about people don't even realize it could be even the mere police contact. It doesn't have to be that it's a kid all the way through in the deep end who served time in a state correctional facility. So I'd like to hear from the three of you some examples of youth, how this has impacted their lives and in what ways.
This is Alyssa. In Meridian, Mississippi, which is a place that's kind of made the news a lot lately for issues related to the school-to-prison pipeline, one of the issues in that community was that kids were, you know, being arrested, adjudicated delinquent, placed on probation, and then any subsequent, you know, school suspension or school misconduct was getting them placed back in detention or getting them brought back before the judge. And in addition to the additional confinement and the time away from their families and the detrimental effects of that, what it also does is it somehow blends the juvenile justice system with the school environment, which should be, you know, nurturing and rehabilitative and trying to keep kids in the classroom opposed to looking for, you know, minor rule violations that are really going to push kids out and keep them out of school for a longer period of time. And we've noticed, you know, several kids who've spent days, you know, at the detention center and were maybe even more likely to be written up because the teachers, the principal knew that they were on probation and that if they were suspended, this would be the consequence.
I think the school collateral consequences are very complex because, you know, at the same time we have this situation that was just described with school-to-prison pipeline and, convictions sort of building on each other, we also have this really, strong demand in the Department of Education to have high-performing schools based on standardized tests. And there's at least some evidence that schools, districts feel a lot of pressure to retain only those students who are performing above a certain criteria. And certainly kids who have been spending time in the juvenile justice system are not getting, the best of America's education system. And so they're more inclined to make it more difficult for those youth to return to school, partially, because they're going to lower the test scores. And, in Philadelphia, you're asking for some concrete examples. In Philadelphia in the early 2000s, the legislature amended its school code to allow the Philadelphia public schools to exclude youth who had been in secure placement or who were on probation from returning to a regular classroom. So if you were going to a public school and then you got into trouble, you went to secure confinement, you come back, you're trying to sort of rebuild your life, start where you left off, get on a better footing, you might be excluded from that school that you went to, and you need to find a new school, which is, for many young people, quite overwhelming on its own, much less having just come out of confinement. But in 2005, the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania ruled that this was unconstitutional. So students now in Pennsylvania can be placed in alternative schools, but only after they've had this individualized assessment of their education. And they can't any longer be categorically excluded from public schools. But I think, you know, in some jurisdictions, this is still very much the norm, and it has all sorts of rippling effects.
I would like to add another example. In Massachusetts, for instance, if I punch and kick a friend of mine on Saturday night and get arrested, I'm likely to be charged with assault and battery with a dangerous weapon if I was wearing a shoe when I made the kick. And I want this example to show and illustrate a couple of the problems with the way the law works in Massachusetts. A prosecutor deciding to prosecute my case can read this as a felony, and under the way prosecutors are interpreting the law right now, can disclose that I'm being charged as a felon to the school principal. The school principal can then use Chapter 71, Section 37H1/2 to suspend me indefinitely until my case is closed. And in Massachusetts, that can be 3 weeks or it can be 9 months. And so as I am indefinitely suspended, if I'm a general population student, not a special ed student, I'm not entitled to any kind of alternative services. And if my school system has an alternative school, I should be so lucky to go there, especially if it's a good one, which not all alternative schools are. But the other thing that's disturbing about my case now is even if it is dismissed, and I have missed anywhere from 3 weeks to 9 months of school, my rap sheet will say assault and battery with a dangerous weapon and will not make clear that my dangerous weapon was my shoe or in some cases my flip-flop or a Starburst candy or a notebook. so this term DW, or dangerous weapon, has really, I think, impacted young people in a bad way in this state because it's not explained. And I think half of the things we throw around in our homes would be dangerous weapons if the court got inside of them. But let's look at a state like Florida, where so many of juvenile records are immediately available, where there's no privacy, where you can buy just about anybody's record for $24 with a Visa card or a MasterCard card. I don't want to denigrate possible charge cards here. But, you know, what's that about? What is Florida hoping to do with its kids? Why is it so harsh there? I don't know. But it is. And you see in some states that this just really, really makes whole swaths of kids feel like there is no hope, there's no point. And in places where it's not very clear, or defenders don't make it clear, or judges don't focus on collateral consequences in their colloquies to young people when they're explaining the consequences of the punishment that they will receive, you have kids being totally cowed when the manager of a grocery store says, well, you better be a good kid because I'm going to check your records, and if you aren't, you're not going to work here. Well, a kid who has a record in a state that gives no right, like California, gives no right for grocery stores to check a juvenile's record, will be cowed by that, will be frightened. I mean, we go all across the country and we find that kids don't even know how to fill out an employment form. They don't know how to answer that question when it exists, have you ever been convicted, because they don't know the terms adjudication. They don't know that they've been adjudicated and not convicted. And, of course, that gets more complicated in states where many kids are transferred into the adult system.
And I want to spend some time talking about, you know, what we can do as professionals in the juvenile justice system or anyone who works with youth to help them better understand the potential consequences of the things we're talking about. But we've really kind of moved into one big area, public policy area, which you all have been talking about, which is background checks and also the access to records. I know in Ohio last year we were able to do some legislative reform to restrict what could be released in background checks, and also reduce the time that to seal and expunge records of youth. So to help facilitate actually them becoming the citizens that we want. So maybe, I don't know, I know, Alyssa, you're working on some stuff in Mississippi. If you want to start us off, what's happening there, and then Lisa, you know, you did this whole analysis for the American Bar Association, and I know you're really involved. So like to hear how states are approaching this issue in particular.
Right. Right now in Mississippi, there's some proposed legislation that would give youth who are convicted of an offense under the age of 18. And so, you know, these would be youth that, you know, were transferred to adult court and convicted of certain felonies. Or one of the other ways that youth could benefit from this legislation is until 2011, Mississippi, if you were 17 years old and you were charged with a felony, you were automatically tried in circuit court, in the adult court system. As of, you know, July 2011, that law was changed, and so now the only 17-year-olds that are automatically tried in circuit court are those that commit a capital offense or an offense with a firearm, and so the deadly weapon. And so, so those youth who may have, you know, a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, 17-year-olds convicted of minor, you know, felonies, other than those that I categories that I just named, would now have an opportunity to seek expungement and have that removed from their record, which hopefully would give them an open some opportunities for them, you know, to reduce the impact of these collateral consequences that we're talking about. And you know, right now that legislation is still moving through the process. You know, it's passed in the House and the Senate, and so it'll be just kind of up to whether the two chambers can agree and come up with a version that would then go on to the governor.
And for listeners who don't know the difference between expungement and sealant, can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, if when something is expunged, it's as though it never happened. When your record is sealed, it still exists, but obviously the access to it is limited. And so that can, depending upon the state's laws, even when something's sealed, and sometimes even in some rare instances when something is expunged, there's still they can still be access to it in very limited circumstances. It may be by law enforcement. It may be by, other certain agencies that, you know, the state says should be able to know that information. But when it's expunged, it's like it never happened.
I think there's some really exciting legislative reform going on. One of the most successful places recently has been Michigan, which has done a great job in changing what is disclosed, how it's collected and circulated. They've done wonderful work there, and they are a bunch of juvenile defenders and juvenile policy experts, and I would strongly recommend folks look at that state as a model. But we're seeing exciting things happening in other parts of the country, like Minnesota. And the legislative reform effort is really, really necessary. We tried for years in Massachusetts, or I should say I tried with colleagues to change things. And the focus was on changing adult protections. And unfortunately, short shrift was given to juvenile protections. And even a simple change that could be made by executive order to say that juvenile records resulting in a null prosecution, in other words, the prosecutor didn't have enough information to continue the prosecution, or dismissal, should not be disclosed to potential employers and universities and military folks, has not succeeded, and it's greatly frustrating to me. I don't know why this information needs to be kept. One of the things we have done in Massachusetts that I think is wise and just a logical model to follow is to have juvenile defenders and folks who understand the juvenile collateral consequences laws to work with youth employment counselors. Increasingly, the work programs and employment programs have required that youth who have been system involved be given special number of slots in these programs, and yet many youth employment counselors are not trained in how collateral consequences will require those youth to forego certain opportunities and to have a much better chance with others. So one thing we strongly recommend is know your collateral consequences for your state and then reach out to youth employment counselors and juvenile defenders and help them get that information out. One way we get that information out is through our Think About It cards, which actually is the idea of Deputy Chief Kenny Green, and you can read about him on our website. When we trained police, which is a lot of what we do, about how to work with juveniles, we gave these officers in Massachusetts a short training in how juvenile law works and collateral consequences. And to his credit, Sergeant Green at the time said, I had no idea these were the consequences. I had no idea that if I arrest a kid, he could lose his housing. I had no sense of what impact an arrest could have. Could you put that information on a card? And so we did. And the Think About It cards are used by police as an icebreaker or sometimes as a warning to say, if you keep doing this and I arrest you, look what you're giving up. And one of the things we find really shocking, that's been a change in the last 20 years, is that if you have even a minor arrest, it's much more difficult to get into the military than it ever was. It used to be that the military is where you sent people who had minor records or needed some so-called straightening out. That is no longer the case. So even a minor transgression can really be the kiss of death. And the military has a don't ask, but if you don't tell, you're in trouble policy. In other words, if you don't disclose you had a minor juvenile record, you get an integrity violation for failing to disclose it, and then you must ask for a waiver. And as the military is cutting the number of people it's inviting into the Army, this means that a lot of kids don't have that option. So in addition to Think About It cards and training youth employment folks, we strongly recommend that people help young people understand how certain opportunities are foreclosed by even very minor involvement in the system. And the Think About It cards, I just want to add, are a good way to open a conversation with young people for a guidance counselor or a youth employment counselor, for anybody. So, you know, if you're hanging, you're working with a kid who's hanging out with a peer group that's repeatedly on the edge of getting arrested, you can say to them, do you want to put your mom's housing at risk? Do you want to prevent yourself from achieving your dream of joining the Marines here? Because you are on that route. And those are the kind of conversations we need to have with young people. But it also, with the value of a Think About It card, is that it raises consciousness. I mean, I thought all my juvenile records would automatically be sealed, or I thought my child's records wouldn't be seen by anybody. Well, no, that's not the case. And so you can build support for some of these legislative reform efforts if you get that information out.
Ashley, I don't know if there are other public policy issue strategies that you see states trying to address to minimize collateral consequences. We've been focusing on background checks and records access. I know in Ohio, when we were thinking about even like system exposure, we also think about it as trying to keep youth in youth-specific treatment centers, or keeping them in youth detention centers if they have to go somewhere out of the adult system. So I don't know if there's anything you can share in what states are looking at and other strategies.
I think that it's definitely correct to say that most of the movement on this is about expungement bills and mostly about expunging after a certain period of time or for particular types of convictions or juvenile versus adult. And we are seeing a fair amount of reform in that area, which is terrific. But there's other areas, I think, too, that are helping with collateral consequences. In Florida, for instance, the legislature is working right now to improve the education that youth receive while they're in detention, funneling more funds to be spent in their juvenile justice education programs, and requiring for money to be cut when it's been demonstrated that those programs are unsatisfactory. So, you know, having more of a focus on better education for those who do end up in the system, you know, helps with the gap that would happen in their education had they been in a juvenile justice system that had poor or no educational services while they're being detained. Another area, I think, is in Illinois, there's a Medicaid re-enrollment bill. So somebody mentioned earlier on the call that, you know, one of the things that happens to youth who get involved in the system, whether they stay in the juvenile system or are transferred to the adult, is sometimes their benefits become deactivated. And so Medicaid is one of those. They may have been on Medicaid before they came in, their family was, and when they become a part of the state institution, those benefits can be terminated, and they can re-enroll once they are released, but that's a process that takes up to 90 days, and often what they need the most and the most quickly is medication for mental health issues. And so we know that kids are more likely to reoffend very early after release, you know, within the first few days. And so to have this gap in their prescription is really just critical. And so to have just a small thing like a Medicaid fix can be enormously helpful to have continuation of services upon exit from the system. So Illinois is working on a bill related to that. And I think, also just considering the repeal that we've seen in several states now of juvenile transfer laws to the adult system, that movement in the 90s in and of itself caused all sorts of collateral consequences. Once you put a juvenile into the adult system, they lose all of the rights that anyone would have had as an adult in the system. So with an adult conviction, they might, never get a chance to vote. They might get, they're susceptible to being deported. There's all sorts of things that could happen as a result of an adult conviction. So just transferring youth back to the juvenile system and repealing those laws seems to be doing, does a lot to remedy these collateral consequences. So those are some of the additional things. And I think just finally, you know, a couple of big publications have been released on juvenile defense standards lately. And, you know, the idea behind this is to make sure that juvenile defense attorneys are letting their clients know, as was mentioned earlier, that these are all the things you risk. So there's a bigger set of resources for attorneys now, I think, than there was before.
I have to agree, and I participated in drafting those standards for juvenile defenders, and we made collateral consequences a thread throughout the standards because we wanted to make sure that defenders were aware. And frankly, we find often judges are not aware of the scope of the impacts of collateral consequences. And let me just give you a quick example of things that a lot of folks aren't aware of just because of the nature of how the system works. Let's say I am charged with possession of pot when I'm 13. I am adjudicated delinquent. I do 3 months probation. It all goes away. When I'm 16 and a half and go apply for my driver's permit, I might find a 6 month to 1 year delay in the ability to receive it because that is one of the collateral consequences of a possession charge. Whether or not we agree with the value of that is irrelevant here, but this is the kind of consequence that defenders weren't even finding out about because it was happening so far after they had represented young people. So the importance of the ABA's project is to have collected all that information in one place. I'm really glad you raised the issue of immigration because while an adjudication is not sufficient to lead to the deportation of a juvenile under current law, the impact of an arrest for a crime of moral turpitude, which may be drug dealing or a sexual offense, is likely to have an impact on young people's families and their naturalization status. It may also, again, be one of these delayed consequences where you think you're okay, but you leave the country and you try to come back and you can't because of an adjudication. And the lack of transparency about all this is what's so disturbing, and that's some of what we've tried to address with our Think About It cards. But these are small cards, and California is a perfect example of the complexity of these systems. For instance, the Pacific Juvenile Defender Center under Patty Lee, Rourke Stacy, Sue Burrell, and Maureen Pacheco created a book on all the collateral consequences of being arrested as a juvenile in one state, in California, and it's probably over 130 pages long.
This is Alyssa again. I just wanted to add that, SPLC is hopeful that this legislation will get passed, and, you know, we kind of recognize, especially listening to Ashley and Lisa, the importance of the next step, which will be the education, to now, you know, adults who could benefit from this because of convictions when they were under 18, as well as, you know, to judges, to other, you know, professionals that are working with this population, and how if the word doesn't get out and if there's not proper education, the benefits of these potential laws, you know, will in some ways never be realized. At least they won't get to the full population that they could help.
Just want to remind our listeners that if they do want to call in and pose any questions to our guests, to call 347-994-1149, and you'll press the number 1 on your telephone keypad. And also feel free to pose questions in our chat room. So a couple things. Again, it's the importance of letting youth know what some of these potential collateral consequences are. And you've mentioned the Think About cards, and we've talked about the standards, which we featured a few months ago, right before they were published. So if people want to listen to that show, and there's also a link on the Children's Law Center to those standards. What other innovative practices are you seeing around the country that are helping judges, attorneys, youth, and other professionals coming into contact with youth understand this issue better?
I'm not seeing too much. That's from my perspective
here. Well, what would you like to
sorry
see, Lisa? I mean, you seem to be in this position, you know, you've been out there creating things, and you've also taken this sort of sweep look of what's going on in the country. You know, and you did mention, you know, who could be some potential allies out there in the education and counseling. Well, I'm sure you have lots of ideas, and what is your wish list at this point?
Well, my wish list is that we would have the money to replicate juvenile, think about it, first cards in every state for every police officer and every probation officer and every school guidance counselor. My second topic on my wish list would be that parents become more aware of this. I think one of you is from Philadelphia. Well, in Philadelphia, the police can give out your juvenile arrest record if you are considered a threat to public safety and pose a risk of terrorism. I mean, why is that on the books, for heaven's sakes? A lot of two-year-olds should be on that list, if you ask me. And why would we do this to a 14-year-old? How is this even logical? So knowing that your child could be put on that kind of list ought to give us pause. But I think too often we as parents really don't worry until it's our kid. And then we don't always circle around and support parents whose kid it's happened to. So I would like more education of all the adults who work with kids about this. As well as not just the laws, but the short and long-term impacts of this kind of approach to punishing young people for their conduct. And I think the other thing is I would much like to see, third on my agenda, is getting youth employment folks and the community of business people aware of how these records look and what they really mean, because there's another huge systemic disjuncture. You have people seeing dangerous weapon and thinking, oh, my God, it was a gun or a knife, when, in fact, you know, it could have been a shoe. Or we had several cases where Starburst candy, which I think is much more dangerous for your teeth than when you throw it, but I could be wrong. So, you know, why aren't we educating those communities? I don't know. Why aren't we auditing where these records are being sent out to make sure they're only going to the legally correct recipients? I don't know. But education's got to be the first step here. And I think in states where you've seen legislative reform, excellent, excellent education has occurred. And the legislatures have said, you know what, this is short-term thinking here to marginalize so many young people for very minor offenses. The vast majority are minor offenses. So it's time to rethink that. And it would be wonderful to see the legislative strategies that were used in these different states compared with each other as an inspiration for others of us who have not had that kind of success.
This is Alyssa. I just would add and kind of echo about the importance of educating parents. And I think just like so many of the rights that were kind of slowly given to juveniles over time, there's going to have to be a place to discuss collateral consequences in the process, whether, you know, in determining, you know, what that should come from the public defender, the youth attorney, potentially the probation officer, and just maybe other people that the youth and the parent are interacting with during their involvement in the juvenile justice system, and knowing that, you know, that person kind of having some responsibility to inform the child and to inform the parent of the potential collateral consequences once kids are involved, and then obviously also trying to do some preventive education, you know, along the lines of the Think About It cards to say, you know, these are the things that could happen if you become court involved.
You know, in Minnesota, they so like this idea, and this is a state where reform is gung-ho, but not yet enacted. The state advisory group, which is part of the Federal Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Act way of distributing federal money in each of the states, the state advisory group there paid to replicate 325,000 copies of the card because they saw the validity of this education effort, and they made a wonderful card there. I invite you to look at it on our website, strategiesforyouth.org. But we're just not doing enough on this. And one of the other groups I forgot to add on my to-do list here is judges. I mean, if judges already are mandated by Supreme Court law to disclose the immigration impacts, why shouldn't they be affirmatively, without being mandated by a decision, telling young people what these other collateral consequences are as a way of saying to them, don't derail your future options here. Let us help you to redirect now, because if you want to go into the military, if you want to do X, if you want to do Y, you're going to lose those options if you continue on this path. And we know that's not going to work for all kids, but we know it's going to work for some kids. And I think judges need to shoulder some of this burden, too. It should not be on the least supported group in the system, namely juvenile defenders, who are not even paid on par in some states with prosecutors. So this should not just be the juvenile defender's obligation. It should be an obligation for them, but not just them.
And I know, Lisa, you had mentioned the manual that California put together. Washington and Pennsylvania also have checklists. And a lot of the resources that the three of you have mentioned, we put on Children's Law Center's website under this show, which is childrenslawky.org, as well as there's a lot of fact sheets there about how Ohio has worked to address collateral consequences. And the three organizations that you all work for, in case people want more information, as you said, Lisa, strategiesforyouth.org. The Southern Poverty Law Center's website is www.splcenter.org, and the Sentencing Project is www.sentencingproject.org. So we're at final thoughts. Ashley, Lisa, Lisa, things that you want to share, why this is so important, and anything else?
Well, I think this is Ashley. I'll just go back to what I, was talking about at the beginning, that, you know, we have really gotten very far off track in terms of why we have a juvenile justice system, and, you know, that we're seeing it in little sort of bits here and there, reforms to the system that bring it back to its original founding principles of keeping youth, as out of the public eye as possible for delinquency matters, and to intervene on their lives, much rehabilitatively as possible, because, you know, there's this general belief that young people are especially capable of reform. And, even the United States Supreme Court has held this in the last 7 years on a number of cases, very prominent cases starting with Roper and ending most recently in Miller, that children are different, and they require more care and more, consideration of the fact that they are evolving beings. And, this notion of lifelong collateral consequences that accompany someone from misbehavior in their teenage years is something that we need to just continue to work toward remedying.
In closing, I guess, to sum up, our conversation today, I just want to add that, in addition to that, the purpose of the juvenile justice system is rehabilitation, is that, in many states, I know in Mississippi, there is a definite amount of time that kids can be required to serve in insecure confinement. And so if we understand that kids should only be in those, insecure confinement, in detention for a short period of time, and understanding the impact that it can have on them, why not then also address these collateral consequences and these other things that maybe, kids who are 14 and 15 don't even realize could affect their lives or not even aware of. Why would we have these long-term consequences when we do understand that we want to rehabilitate children? That's the goal of this system, and that's why, we want to provide wraparound services and all of the other services and programming that accompany the juvenile justice system to hopefully ensure that, any kind of delinquent conduct that happens during adolescence doesn't reoccur, that these kids are our children, and they'll grow up and become doctors and lawyers and dentists and not, you know, reenter the criminal justice system as adults and be incarcerated. And so the way that we can begin to educate and, you know, through legislative and policy reform, minimize the impact of these collateral consequences will really just further serve the purpose of our juvenile justice system.
Great, thank you. Lisa?
I would just add that everything my colleagues have said is spot on, right? And not only do we need to rethink what the point of juvenile justice is, we have so much information, so much research now that makes clear that being arrested and court-involved is a highly traumatic experience. It is an impressive and painful lesson for many kids. So they have a change in self-image that a collateral consequence will either concretize or not. And if we say that's all you are, that's the sum of who you are, nothing good you do is sufficient to overcome that that action, we have said to them, you're not worth it. And I hope that's not what we mean to say. And it is what we're saying in a lot of places, so we need to change what we're saying to young people. We need to give them a way back. Just as so many adults have found a way back, we have to offer this to kids. Otherwise, we're not civilized. And it's time that we look at certain states' laws and make sure they're 21st century and that they're as developmentally appropriate and the treatment of youth is as developmentally competent as it needs to be, as the Supreme Court has urged us to be.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Our next show will focus on the role of research-based risk assessments in juvenile justice and features a new publication on that subject. If you have ideas for future shows, you can email them to me, Lauren, at childrenslaw@ispconsults.com. And to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth.